Easter candy right now. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. On this portion of the WGTD Morning Show, we are very fortunate to spend a few minutes with noted Kenosha cardiologist, Dr. Kevin Fullen. Dr. Fullen will be part of a program coming up on Tuesday, March 15th, at the Kenosha Hospital Medical Center. It is called Prevent, Reverse, and Diminish Coronary Heart Disease and Other Common Disorders. Dr. Fullen, we're very grateful for your time this morning.
Oh, thank you so much.
Why don't you just, first of all, set up what's going to be taking place there and your interest in it.
So on March 15th at noon at Kenosha Hospital Medical Center, Dr. Caldwell Esselton, he's a pioneer in what we call a whole food plant-based diet. He has done extensive work that actually has shown that patients of his that have been on this diet were able to reverse heart disease. More specifically, patients that had an angiogram that showed blockages in the arteries that went on this diet and then went on to have another angiogram showed the blockages that actually disappeared. In fact, aside from just disappearance of the blockage on the angiogram, these patients also went on not to have heart attacks and need stents or bypass surgery. So Dr. Esselton appeared in the movie called Fork Over Knives. That's a book that's a video. It's also a cookbook that describes some of the great work that he pioneered. We're really fortunate to have him come to Kenosha, and he's going to share his lifetime work in this area.
Well, I think you caught everybody's attention just describing Dr. Esselton and his work. But you have implemented this now into your life and your practice, have you not?
Well, I have because about 5 years ago when I watched Fork Over Knives, they made the claim that it can reverse heart disease. And I'm like, boy, I would sure like to be able to do that. So right inspired by that movie, I adopted that in my own life. But then I adopted it for any patients. For instance, when you go to Kenosha Hospital, the dietitians, the diabetic educators can instruct you on the diet. We have information on this. And many of my patients have done this with the same good results that Dr. Esselton has pioneered. So he's been an inspiration to me from the very start, and I'm delighted that he can be with us.
Well, let's bring this down now to the real basics. In other words, what kind of foods, what kind of a menu would be part of this lifestyle, because we don't want to eat bamboo shoots. We do like our shamrock shakes. what do you really have to start eliminating or at least cutting back on?
First of all, in terms of what you don't want to eat, is you don't want to eat meat. And when I say meat, that means all animals. That means anything with a face or eyes or a tail. So and then that includes not using dairy, which would, of course, would include not eating cheese. And, of course, in Dr. Esselton, we don't use any oil as well. This is the diet in particular that's been shown to reverse heart disease. But put it in a more positive light, what do we eat? Eat whole grains, all kinds of fruits and vegetables is what's allowed. And a lot of times when I've given talks in the community, what I particularly try to emphasize is what delicious food you can have. I consider myself a foodie, and I really enjoy eating delicious food. But I also enjoy eating food that's healthy for me, that makes me feel better, that helps prevent chronic illnesses.
We're talking to Kevin Fullen, the noted Kenosha cardiologist, and he's going to be taking part in a program next Tuesday, the 15th, called Prevent, Reverse, and Diminish Coronary Heart Disease and Other Common Disorders. So why don't we, if we could go over a breakfast, a lunch, and a dinner that you, Dr. Kevin Fullen, eat on a typical day? What would you have for breakfast?
I eat today like I typically eat. So this morning I had steel cut oats with blueberries, and I did happen to put a little flax meal in there as well. Has a lot of antioxidants in it and omega-3s as well. This is a delicious, sustaining breakfast. And, of course, for lunch I'll usually have some type of salad. But in my salad, I'm going to not use any oil, but I'll use vinegar. I'll use any nuts or fruits in there. And for dinner, it can be, I might have some whole grain pasta. I'll mix that with lots of mushrooms. Mushrooms, we say whole food plant-based, but we should include fungus in there because mushrooms have a tremendous anti-cancer effect, and I like to eat them regularly. Then I'll for sure have some more greens with that, and that would be very typical day for me, and it's really delicious.
I can presume someone as erudite as yourself has a number of friends. How do you then, when you're going to go out to dinner with somebody else, how do you work that into this lifestyle?
So I tend to just go wherever people want to go, but I tend to order a lot of sides, so I'm gonna get the baked potato. In fact, I was recently in a restaurant and ordered a baked potato, and it came with about a quarter stick of butter, which I had to immediately scrape off.
That's the best part, doctor. That is
sour
That's
cream.
The best part.
You have to really order your loaded potato unloaded.
Yeah. tell me this then. I'm a runner, not a good one, but I'm a runner, so I'm marginally, concerned about my diet. Protein, where do you get your protein from then in this kind of lifestyle?
That's probably the most common question asked, and people look at me and say, where do you get your protein? I ask them, do I look protein deficient? but the thing is, you will get all the protein that you need just eating plants and vegetables. And the reason why that's the case is, number one, there's protein in that type of diet. But number two, your protein needs are really very low. So lower than most people think. I know many people are taking protein shakes and are concerned about their protein, but actually it's the excess of animal protein. In particular, they're turning on genes that are causing coronary disease, diabetes, cancer in particular. And so it's something that we're going to become protein deficient. It's something that something that's really been sold by the meat and dairy industry as of great concern.
In our remaining few minutes, I want to ask you a serious question in a moment. I want to ask you just a little bit of a fun question. When you cheat on this diet, what do you do to cheat?
Well, if I was... I always am perfectly honest, so things I still crave are anchovies, which are not good for you. I don't recommend. But you have to remember that it's not a religion. So I find in general that what keeps you sticking to the diet is that you feel better, you feel healthier. That's really what's going to keep you on it.
Yeah. We're talking to Dr. Kevin Fullen, Chief of Staff at United Hospital System, a noted cardiologist here in Kenosha. You touched on something early on in this interview, and as we come to our last couple of minutes here, I hope you could expand on it a little bit. You call it, we can now reverse heart disease.
Yes.
So people have already had a heart attack or have had bypasses or have had, like I had, a valve replacement. There is a way to change all that, change the course of that, and fix that, and you're telling us that this is a lifestyle we really should at least look at and consider, correct?
So the patients that Dr. Esselstein worked with are patients that were in the Cleveland Clinic that already had multiple angioplasties and stents and advanced heart disease and are basically turned down by the cardiologist for further intervention. And what I'm saying is that even if you have very severe heart disease, you universally benefit from making these changes. In my practice, if someone has a heart attack, it's really a teachable moment where you say, look, you know, I can do the plumbing, I can put a stent in, I can do this or that, but we have to change the fundamental problem. We can't spend our time mopping up the floor without turning off the faucet. So we have to change the environment in your body that's causing the plaques to begin with, or you end up getting another procedure or more stents. So I used to pride myself on how well I took care of patients by fixing their recurring blockages, but now I take pride in when the patient comes and sees me that they have no further procedures because they changed their diet, they changed their environment, they changed their risk factors.
Dr. Kevin Fullen, Chief of Staff, United Hospital System in Kenosha. Once again, the program is titled Prevent, Reverse, and Diminish Coronary Heart Disease and Other Common Disorders. And it features Dr. Caldwell Esselstein, Tuesday, March 15th, from 7 till 8:45 p.m. at the Kenosha Hospital Medical Center. Dr. Fullen, we thank you very kindly for joining us today on the WGTD Morning Show.
Oh, thanks so much.
I'm sure many of you know well the name of Machiavelli. But just because one recognizes the name does not mean that one is in a position to really fully appreciate this Italian writer and philosopher and historian's importance in the shaping of many of our modern attitudes about political power, about the waging of war, and so on. Machiavelli was a hugely important figure in his own time, and if anything, has grown in significance and influence over the intervening years. He died in 1527, and it is in the wake of his death that we are only slowly maybe coming to develop an even greater appreciation for who he was and the extraordinary circumstances under which he did his important, influential writing. A new book has just been written and published called Machiavelli, A Life Beyond Ideology. And the author of the book is Paul Oppenheimer. And Professor Oppenheimer is professor of comparative literature at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He has a number of different books to his credit, including several volumes of poetry, some fiction, and also books including The Birth of the Modern Mind, Evil and the Demonic, Infinite Desire, and Till Eulenspiegel, His Adventures. Again, this new book published by Continuum is called Machiavelli, A Life Beyond Ideology. And Professor Paul Oppenheimer, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning. It's very nice of you to have me.
I wonder if you could, before we begin talking about Machiavelli and your book about him, if you could just say a word about what is meant by the term comparative literature. That is what you teach at City University.
Yes, of course. Well, the idea is that no piece of literature, whatever it is, exists in a vacuum. It's the result of influences, many of them from other cultures and countries than one's own, and it's the result of mythology and folklore often buried in one's mind without one's knowing it. Comparative literature is an attempt to find out what all those influences are, to see what operates on the Bible, for instance. Outside of just the King James culture that produced the modern translation. And so what you get there is a fascinating attempt to move cross-culturally and begin to see how somebody such as, say, Machiavelli in the 16th century has had an influence on maybe American democracy in the 20th and the 21st century.
You have written a really intriguing array of books. I apologize in saying that I have yet to read any of these works, but I am inspired to seek out several of them on the strength of the titles alone. I wonder if you could just say a word about what ties together what seems like a very interesting array of subject matters on which you have written.
Well, I've gotten interested in puzzles. I guess I'm one of those queer fellows who likes to solve problems, or try to. So when we come to the subject of evil, it's always seemed to me, and this ties in with Machiavelli, of course, that it's not simply a religious term, but that it must refer to something beyond the criminal, beyond ordinary comprehensions of what is bizarre, grotesque, dangerous, and frightening. And so that's an attempt to analyze evil, Evil in the Demonic, the book I wrote on evil, in terms of experience, of what people actually experience in their lives, and what cultures and countries do as well. With my biography of Rubens, which I published some years ago, Peter Paul Rubens, the painter, I was trying to explore the peculiarity of his style, that he seems to be very interested in depicting motion, even in paintings. Eventually, that leads into cinematography. It also leads into Einsteinian physics, which is all about motion and looking at the universe as though it were nothing but a series of movements. And this ties in with Machiavelli also, because in trying to investigate the sources of modern thought, I was drawn to him as the first person in a major way to start to look at societies not as fixed things, but as constantly changing. The question for him was, how do you describe a social apparatus that is constantly in flux, that is never going to be the same again? And what happens to people, and this is another challenge that Machiavelli faced, who are deeply attached to some ideology or other and then find that it cannot be maintained? For example, if you believe in a system of values, if you believe, for instance, that you should never lie, as a lot of us do, what happens when you are in a position of political power and face a conflict in which it may be in the best interests of your society to lie? Or if you are a believer in communism or capitalism or any of the fancy ideologies that we know about these days, and then find that it doesn't work or that it has to be modified, or even if you're a believer in democracy and find that it won't hold up in all circumstances. These are the kinds of issues that he began to take up in an attempt to deal with change. To put this in another way, Machiavelli and his contemporaries believed in the goddess Fortuna. This didn't mean, and she didn't mean, good luck in the modern sense, although we get our modern word fortune from it. What it meant for him, and this is his definition, is simply changing circumstances. And they always change. By circumstances, he didn't just mean people. In other words, people that you might meet again after an absence of some years and then find that they had totally different ideas about things. But also bad weather, such as hurricanes, typhoons, earthquakes, landslides, mudslides, all of this kind of thing, which could not be anticipated and can never be anticipated, but which will undoubtedly have a huge influence on the cultures in which they occur. Hmm. How do you deal with all this sort of thing politically?
He was about, in a sense, honesty and openness when it came to such matters. For instance, about matters of hypocrisy, of at certain points turning one's back on a firmly held belief for some other reason. I think at one point you write words to the effect that he believed there was no reason to be hypocritical about hypocrisy. It was a necessary component when one is a political leader.
Yes, I think most people are too attached, at least from his point of view, to cherish beliefs of one sort or another. And this clouds their thinking about the political world in which they may be living. So, in other words, to go back to the issue of lying again, if one is a devout believer in the sanctity of truth, and many of us like to think of ourselves as exactly that, one may not be willing to give up that belief no matter what happens. And this will mean, in some cases, that one will simply be swept aside as a ruler or leader. The river moves on, and one never steps into the same river twice. This is the kind of issue that fascinated him.
Hmm. And this helps us understand why you've chosen to entitle your book, Machiavelli, A Life Beyond Ideology.
Yes, that's the whole point, actually. He could not see how anyone would be able to sustain an ideology in anything like its pure form. In other words, he believed that you would have to act treacherously if you wanted to stay in power. This doesn't mean that you can never do anything good or that you should not go into politics. It does mean, at least from his point of view, that you're going to run into tremendous conflicts over the question of ideological purity, so to speak. And from his point of view, you won't be able to sustain it.
So did he believe that then one should not even state ideologies? I mean, because if you state that you believe something and are going to live and die by it, the moment you in fact find yourself compelled to release that or turn your back on that or have to compromise that, it in a sense puts a target on you. Would he have people not sort of publicly hold ideology at all?
I don't think he would have gone that far. I think he would have suggested that if you want to be honest about it, you will have to say that this may not work, whatever the ideological belief might be, in every situation. Again, a lot of people will have immense problems with this, and in a society such as ours, for, let's say, a presidential candidate to start saying something like that might lead into instant accusations of flip-flopping. We see that all the time. Flip-flopping might be good, it might be bad, it might be opportunistic, it might be foolish, but it would be the kind of thing that one would have to do, at least from Machiavelli's point of view, if one was going to survive. Again, the question is survival or political stability. He lived in a time that was really rough and ready. It was full of plague in the form of disease, killing off half the population of Florence just before he was born. It was full of constant wars right around him. One of the reasons that he is so different from other writers on politics, or history for that matter, is that he actually lived through enormous amounts of violence, and he saw it at first hand. He was involved with armies created by his own Republic of Florence, although he was never a soldier. But he was a strategist. He was involved with politics at very high levels in the Republic of Florence, which was, during that period, a kind of democracy. Not the kind that we have, but in many ways a democracy. And therefore, as a top-ranking civil servant, got to see how a state actually worked. Most people writing on politics, even very good ones, don't have that kind of experience. And so what you're getting with him in his great books, such as The Prince, which is a manual of how to govern a state, and which came out only 5 years after his own death, he never saw it in print, is a description of what's going to be necessary to guarantee stability in the face of constant attempts by enemies and others to undermine what you are doing.
You write at one point, Machiavelli was forced to seek out rare islands of contemplation amid a sea of blustery disorders. And
yes,
you draw a sharp contrast between that and maybe an academic or otherwise a philosopher who, in the solitude and comfort and safety and stability of their study up in the mountains someplace, puts pen to paper and writes all kinds of profound thoughts on how the world works and how humans interact and so on. And you're painting a picture of Machiavelli doing his writing, or at least doing his thinking and mental construction amidst all kinds of chaos and mayhem.
Yes, that's in part true. Most of his reports home from his various diplomatic missions are written under those conditions. On the other hand, when the Medici, the immensely wealthy family that had ruled Florence before its return to a kind of republican condition at the beginning of the 16th century, came back to power in 1512, exactly 500 years ago now, he was forced out, and he retired in a kind of quasi-exile to his family estate, which is just outside of Florence. It's about 9 or 10 miles out, and actually not on a mountain, but on a hill. And there he stayed off and on for years, doing a lot of the writing that he's become so famous for, including the writing of The Prince. On the other hand, even while he was there, he involved himself in the politics of his day through the letters he was constantly sending to friends of his who were in Rome and often serving the Pope there, and on diplomatic missions of various sorts. He was involved even while he wasn't there, so to speak, and constantly trying to come back.
And one still has this sense that whatever he came to believe about the nature of politics and of how just our civil life functions, that those beliefs were brewed in cold, hard, harsh reality. And not in the abstract, for instance, of the classroom.
Yes. I mean, he was an immensely well-educated person. He was trained as a humanist in Latin, for example, not in Greek. But he had read the classics, and so that made him a humanist in his day. There are scholars, many of them very good ones, who have tried to classify him as a Democrat. I think you run into trouble when you try to classify him in that way. I mean, Democrat with a lowercase d. Because he's not really an ideologue of any sort, although he has, of course, a deep sympathy for Republican ideals and for parliaments and for voting and for public participation in government. He certainly has an enthusiasm for all that, no question. But he's a realist, exactly as you say. And what his question is how it is possible to maintain a state in the midst of the constant surging tides of misery and circumstance that are all around one. Can that be done? That's the kind of question that Lincoln faced with the American Civil War. It's the kind of question that comes up over and over again today. In other words, it's coming up with the Arab Spring. It may come up with what could become a Chinese or a Russian winter. Who knows? These ideas are very pertinent right now as instability looms on the horizon for all of us.
We're speaking with Paul Oppenheimer, who is author of Machiavelli, A Life Beyond Ideology. I was struck by the fact that you open the chapter that begins chronicling the life of Machiavelli, his 58 years of life, by referring to the mystery of his life. The mystery of his life begins in 1469. Explain to our listeners why you would describe his life in that way. In what way is the life of Machiavelli a mystery?
Well, it's a mystery in the primal sense that he seems to come out of nowhere and be so different in many ways from his contemporaries, many of whom were very brilliant people. And some of them are very different, too, in the genius sense from anybody we've ever seen before. I'm thinking of Leonardo da Vinci, for example, whom Machiavelli knew and worked with on a project to alter the path of a river, the Arno, running through Florence down to Pisa. Or Michelangelo, whom he also knew. These kinds of brilliant people are, in a sense, a bit like him. There is no way to anticipate the emergence of Machiavelli's peculiar and exciting kind of clarity of thought, which is what still excites anybody who picks up The Prince to read it, or his commentaries on the Roman historian Livy to read that, or his plays. He's a wonderful playwright who influences Shakespeare and modern drama. Where does all this come from? You can argue that there are anticipations, that there are suggestions, because he is surrounded, as I say, by some other quite brilliant people. Nonetheless, there's no way to anticipate, and this is mysterious about him, the immense clarity of the originality of his thinking, even when he picks up the same evidence as everybody else is handling. One thing to, for example, keep in mind is that he insists all through his life on bringing a kind of journalism into historical writing. He argues that complete clarity of language is what we need. Let's get rid of the jargon. Let's get rid of senseless complexity. Let's stick to the facts. Let's describe situations. In letter after letter, he makes it clear that if you can describe something so as to bring your audience into feeling it and knowing it, then you will have succeeded in doing something. But where does that idea come from? He's surrounded by other historians who also do very fine work and who are friends of his, and yet his is different and, I think, well in advance of its day.
One intriguing contrast that you draw between Machiavelli and many of the people who were of his world and of his time, so to speak, is when you talk about this being an era in which so many people would focus on and be driven by or guided by omens, prophecies, witchcraft, demons, ghosts, astrology. And I think you make reference to such matters disturbing most European brains. And Machiavelli was about seeing the world and understanding the world and understanding future events in particular, apart from the list that I just read.
Yeah, it's very difficult for people to break away from superstition in his day. The influence of exactly what you've just been talking about, witchcraft, and all sorts of superstitions, including astrology, is enormous. He manages to retain his skepticism in the face of all that. And it's astonishing to see how that is done. The world seems itself to be on the verge of great changes as he is writing. One of the concepts that he doesn't actually know about, but which is beginning to surface in painting and in the literature of his time without being exactly named, is that of infinity, or the notion that the universe must be much larger than anybody had ever imagined that it would be. Within 150 years, the ideas of Galileo would begin to alter scientific perceptions along these very lines. Machiavelli is at the cusp of that shift into the understanding that we can analyze physical reality in an empirical way, and we can do so systematically.
One of the observations you make that I especially appreciated about this, I've never seen anybody make this point, or at least as clearly as you did, is in talking about living one's life and understanding the world in this way, you draw such an interesting contrast for the typical person of this age between those facets of their life where they would be fairly rational and empirical versus those other arenas or other topics or subjects in which they would discard that. Any trust in rational empirical investigation through common enough were for merchants, architects, farmers, weavers, and so on, as they enjoyed their trades, seemed abandoned once they turned their attention to politics, law, war. I mean, in other words, in those really big matters of life, suddenly the sort of nuts and bolts understanding of how things work with which they would do their own jobs or carry out their own trades, it's like those just didn't apply when it came to these kind of larger-than-life issues. I found that to be a really interesting, I don't know, disconnect.
Yes, I would agree it is a disconnect. There may be a kind of space which Machiavelli sees that comes into play in the human mind when it starts to think about politics or government that, of course, it won't be thinking along the lines of if it's concerned with, say, farming or practicing law or doing medicine or writing music. In other words, where you've got to pay attention to the physical facts on the ground, so to speak. Suddenly, when one starts to think about government, a strange opening seems to emerge, and a kind of idealism which may not work or not always work comes into play. I think he was very interested in that kind of issue, that problem.
I wonder if you could say a word more about the way in which life in Italy and, of course, and much of Europe was especially difficult at this time, and the way in which Italy was, in your words, an ideal, if unusual, laboratory in which Machiavelli could study politics in the raw, that is, politics without ideology. You point to some what you call cruel contrasts in various aspects of life, which seem to have made a deep impression on Machiavelli.
Yes, there are these contradictions or paradoxes. In other words, on the one hand, in Florence itself, this brilliant candy box of a city, as it still is today, some of the most wonderful architecture that one can imagine is being produced over a couple of centuries, Renaissance architecture by such people as Brunelleschi, who constructs the great cathedral, or Duomo there, and others such as Machiavelli, who contributes so wonderfully to the Vatican and Rome. You have this brilliance, this immense achievement that startles the world forever, this understanding that beauty can triumph in some way. And on the other, you have masses of diseased and hopeless and helpless people, often thrust into military conflicts of which they have no control, who are surrounded by hired soldiers and assassins who are willing to do virtually anything for a price. This is the kind of disorganization that he lived with. Another way to think about it is that there were no police forces. If you were in trouble and might require the assistance of a constabulary, you did not know where to turn. Soldiers might just as easily switch sides for better pay as remain loyal to their employers. Treachery was so commonplace that it becomes a kind of motif of life. So it's this sort of mess, in a sense, that one is running into. On the other hand, even while Florence is immersed in wars, and it conducts a 12 to 15 year war against its own town of Pisa, Florence is a large republic at this time, it is also prosperous. It is also quiet. It is also, on occasion, a place where, while riots may occasionally break out, there is a great possibility for education and study. These are the contradictions. There's none of the organization that most of us are familiar with in modern life in the 21st century. We don't have the kinds of credentials available in Machiavelli's day, and this is an important issue that we've got now. I think it's important to keep that kind of thing in mind. In other words, you couldn't identify yourself to almost anybody except through how you spoke. There were no credit cards, driver's licenses, passports. None of these kinds of things existed. Even dictionaries did not exist. And it's worth remembering that Shakespeare, living over 100 years later, did not have a dictionary available to him. So that you had to remember everything. Culture functioned mnemonically, and your memory had better be pretty well organized if you were going to survive.
One theme which comes up repeatedly in your book is about the rise of naturalism and humanism. Can you speak a word about that? First of all, what those terms really mean in this context? And
yeah.
I don't mean that Machiavelli would have been acquainted with those terms as such, but what they have to do with him. I mean, was he, in a sense, leading the charge or riding the wave of this shift in thought?
I think he is. The term, as you say, did not exist, naturalism. Riding not a charge, but a kind of trend towards what I would call naturalism. And by that I simply mean that in painting you're depicting what you see, not what you imagine, although that will figure in to some extent, depending on the kind of painting you're doing, with the nature that you present in your pictures. In writing, it means a description of circumstances as they actually are, and again, a reduction in imagining these circumstances or letting them be altered by, say, one's religious beliefs. An attempt, in other words, to be as empirical as possible. And this coincides in painting with the discovery of the vanishing point. In other words, that way of presenting a picture in seemingly three dimensions, and this comes about just prior to Machiavelli's birth with Brunelleschi and other artists such as Uccello, that allows one to depict a three-dimensional scene in a virtually realistic way, with the buildings proportional to their surroundings. This kind of thing begins to creep into political writing, and then in an extravagant way to become dominant in his own political writing. This is where The Prince comes from, and his other writings on history. What he's attempting to do is explore things as they are, not as we wish them to be.
Could you say a word about, we've spoken so much about the turbulence of the world in which Machiavelli lived, the turbulence of the world and times. Could you say a word about, in a sense, the turbulence of Machiavelli's own life? That is, his rise and then his fall. That is an intriguing story in and of itself.
Yes, he came to power in a civil service sense, although he was elected to rather top positions in the city as a civil servant in the city that is a Republic of Florence. At the beginning of the 16th century, just before that. And then, as I said earlier, for the next 12 years, he functions as a civil servant sent out on diplomatic missions. He's never an ambassador, but he is a top-level assistant dealing with such important and ruthless generals as Cesare Borgia and helping to administer armies in various parts of the Florentine Republic, and dispatched to Germany and France, as well as to various parts of Italy, including Rome, on the business of the Signoria, which is the Florentine governing council or body. Then the Medici return, this lavishly wealthy and ferociously ambitious family, in 1512. When that happens, Machiavelli is falsely accused of having conspired against them. The truth is they simply didn't trust him because he had worked for a Republican government. He is arrested, and then he is tortured. The kind of torture to which he was subjected was pretty conventional, but horrible. He was hoisted on the strapado, as it is called. You had your hands cuffed behind your back, and then with a machine consisting of a kind of lever, were lifted above the ground until your arms were wrenched out of their sockets and your shoulders dislodged as well. It was an exceedingly painful type of experience. He went through this and was eventually released. But what's interesting, and it gives you a kind of taste of his character, is that immediately after his experience on the strapado, he turned to writing sonnets, producing three of them, it seems, within a few days, addressing them to one of the Medicis from whom he still hoped to gain some favor. He didn't. And on his release from prison, retired to his villa farm outside of Florence in Sant'Andrea in Piercusina, where with his family he remained a resident off and on for the next 7 or 8 years, with occasional trips to Florence thrown in, coming back. It's worth mentioning throughout all this that he was apparently a very happily married man. He had mistresses, quite a few of them. He had six children, not all of whom survived, but he was loved by his wife and children. That seems very clear.
I thought it was very interesting that we see so prominently in your book the sack of Rome in 1527, which of course comes just ahead of Machiavelli's death. I wonder if you could explain the significance of it. I mean, not that in and of itself it isn't incredibly significant, in the history of our own civilization, for that matter, but the way in which it matters as we come to understand Machiavelli and his place in this part of our history.
I found it enormously important, although it's a coincidence, that Machiavelli dies just before, just after, rather, the city of Rome is sacked by invading German and French armies. The city itself was, in a sense, by no means as important as it had been in ancient Roman times, or as it is today. In other words, its population had been drastically reduced to about 55,000, although the city geographically was still quite immense, and its brilliant libraries and castles were present for everyone to see, and of course it was the center of Christendom or of the papacy. But the destruction of this city was symbolic. It signified, and that's what I try to suggest in my book, the shifting from one universe to another, from one world to another, from certainly one historical period to another, as we move out of the Renaissance and into what you might call a modern period of jumble and chaos and anarchy. So therein lies the significance. It's as though his own ideas about treachery in politics were gaining a kind of horrible fruition.
And particularly, I suppose, the way in which he railed against people living in fantasy, failing to confront the reality that was perhaps right in front of them.
Yes, this he witnesses often. The Pope, in command of defending armies at Rome, for example, seems completely unaware of what's about to happen to him. And in fact, it's the indifference to actual circumstances among many political leaders that Machiavelli constantly writes about, not only in The Prince, but in his commentaries on Livy, which I mentioned earlier. Even in his book, The Art of War, which is still read at military academies around the world, because it makes great suggestions about how wars were conducted and still can be conducted, he draws attention to generals and other commanders who seem so wedded to their ideas about how battles should be conducted that they cannot really conduct them.
That is Paul Oppenheimer. His book is called Machiavelli, A Life Beyond Ideology. 8:57, that wraps up the Friday edition of The Morning Show. And we do remind you, support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College's Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about their wide assortment of Easter candy available right now. And, of course, don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha. Online at andreasgifts.com. Coming up next week on The Morning Show on Monday, Greg will talk to Diane Portnoy. She's the author of a book called Immigrant Struggles, Immigrant Gifts. On Tuesday, Nan Calvert and the monthly visit of the United Environmental Council. Along with Nan, there'll be Sister Janet Weicker, Jane Herring, and David Rhodes. They'll be talking about EcoFest 2016. Wednesday, jazz pianist Kenny Werner. He's performing a concert at UW Parkside. Thursday, opera composer Jake Heggie, his chamber opera, Three Decembers, is being performed at the Milwaukee Florentine Opera. And then on Friday, the monthly visit from the president of Gateway Technical College, Brian Albrecht. Should be partly sunny. Some patchy fog yet this morning. Then sunny and pleasant for the afternoon. A high of 53 inland, cooler near Lake Michigan. Still some areas of fog. 38 Racine, 33 Kenosha, 32 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. NPR News and